faithful during the Ephesus church period. And the promise was, or is, in verse 7, "He that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith unto the churches. To him that overcometh will I give to eat of the tree of life which is in the midst of the paradise of God." Now why should that promise be so special to that people? You find, of course, that the promises to all the other churches are different. Each one of them is different, suiting the exact need of that particular church. Now first of all then, to whom is the promise given? To those who overcome during that dark period when apostasy began to sink its roots deep into the early Christian church. Now because of the apostasy at that time, those who were faithful to God were deprived of translation, just as because of the unbelief of ancient Israel, Kadesh Barnea, Moses and Aaron, Caleb and Joshua, who did not sin at that time against the Holy Spirit, and who did not therefore deprive themselves of the right to go into the promised land, were forced to spend the next 40 years of wandering in the desert. Now to Caleb and Joshua, God gave a very specific and wonderful promise, and the promise was that even though, to the unbelief of the rest of Israel, they could not then enter the promised land, they would do so in 40 years' time. Now, could God have made to Caleb and Joshua a nicer promise than that? He couldn't, could he? That was a promise which exactly suited their particular need and approved of and rewarded their personal faithfulness to God and to his ways. Now, in the days of the early apostolic church, for instance, we think of men like Peter, James and John, of Paul, Andrew and the other apostles, and men like Timothy and Barnabas and many other faithful workers of that period of time who did not participate in the apostasy. Men who throughout their entire lifetime did not leave their first love. Men who had a character and an experience of such quality that if every other believer had shared with them in their faithfulness, what would have happened to that church? It would have been translated. They would have eaten of the tree of life long, long ago. But because of the apostasy of the church in general, what did Peter, James and John have to do? They had to go to their graves, right? But even as they went down to their graves, the promise rang in their ears, a time would come when they would even yet eat of that tree of life which is in the midst of the paradise of God. Now, of course, there's a second and very beautiful application to this promise as well. We don't have to wait until the Lord returns to eat of that tree of life, because we're told in the Spirit of prophecy that the leaves of that tree still hang over the wall, and it is our privilege to eat of that tree even at the present time. Let me just direct your attention to a statement or two in the Bible commentary on this particular point. Of course, that tree represents the unfolding, or the outflowing, I should better say, of the life of God into the souls of those of us who learn to wait upon the Lord to renew our strength from day to day. I turn then to page 988 and 989, volume 7 of the Bible commentary. Here it says, "The fruit of the tree of life in the Garden of Eden possessed supernatural virtue. To eat of it was to live forever. Its fruit was the antidote of death. Its leaves were for the sustaining of life and immortality. But through man's disobedience, death entered the world. Adam ate of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, the fruit of which he had been forbidden to touch. His transgression opened the floodgates of woe upon our race. After the influence of sin, the heavenly husbandman transplanted the tree of life to the paradise above, but its branches hang over the wall to the lower world. Through the redemption purchased by the blood of Christ, we may still eat of its life-giving fruit. Of Christ it is written, 'In him was life, and the life was the light of men.' He is the fountain of life. Obedience to him is the life-giving power that gladdens the soul. Christ declares, 'I am the bread of life. He that cometh to me shall never hunger, and he that believeth in me shall never thirst.' John 6:57, 63, And Revelation 2 verse 7, last part, is quoted at this point. And there are more statements, of course, along this line on these two pages. So even today, by partaking of Christ's life on a daily basis through communion with him, we can still partake of that glorious tree of life and be sustained and refreshed in the ministry which God gives to us. Now coming back then to verse 1, we'll look now at the way in which Jesus Christ was revealed to this particular church, and we'll ask ourselves why this revelation of Jesus Christ was so appropriate to that church at that particular period. How is Christ revealed? We'll read it now in verse 1. Unto the angel of the church of Ephesus write, these things saith he that holdeth the seven stars in his right hand, who walketh in the midst of the seven golden candlesticks. That is the revelation of Jesus Christ. Now, what would such a revelation of Jesus Christ mean to the church of that particular time? Let's ask ourselves some questions about this and ask them of you. Now, who had commissioned Jesus Christ to walk up and down in the midst of the seven golden candlesticks and to hold the seven stars in his right hand? Who had given him that work?
Father.
Right. His Father had. Who else? This was a divine commission to Jesus Christ. Now, by giving that work to Christ, then by so doing, what was the Father declaring in effect? I am the Father of my Son Jesus Christ. And by Christ accepting that work, what was he declaring? His sonship, right? He was declaring his sonship. And therefore, to that church, Jesus Christ was being revealed as one who maintained a very, very close relationship with his Father, and who at the same time was offering the same relationship to his church. But he was saying to them, as I am in the midst of my Father and bound to my Father, even so I stand in the midst of this church and offer you a very, very close fellowship relationship with myself. Now, is that what that church needed to know? Is that what that church needed to see at that point of time? It certainly was. It was extremely important that at that very time the church was able to recognize its need to maintain that relationship between Christ and itself. It was the only way in which that church could be guarded against apostasy, by their recognizing who they were in relationship to the head of the church, which in fact was Jesus Christ himself. So therefore, there could not have been a more appropriate manifestation of the position and work of Jesus Christ to that church than to reveal him as the one who walked up and down in the midst of the seven golden candlesticks, the one who held the seven stars in his right hand. As we said a moment ago, of course, the Ephesus church was the beginning of this long descent into papal darkness. Let's move on now to Smyrna, the second church in the series. And the record of this begins in verse 7 of chapter 2 and runs down to verse 11. Now, just as with the Ephesus church, there are three parts. The first part is the revelation of Christ to that church. The second part is the commendation and or condemnation. In this case, it's only commendation. And finally, of course, there is the promise to the overcomers during that church period. Let's go back there and read from verse 7 to 11 to get this picture, this overall picture of the message very clear in mind, looking for these three parts as we go on through. Verse 7 down to verse 11. He that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith unto the churches. To him that overcometh will I give to eat of the tree of life, which is in the midst of the paradise. I beg your pardon, that should be verse 8, my mistake. Verse 8. And unto the angel of the church in Smyrna write, these things saith the first and the last, which was dead and is alive. I know thy works, and tribulation, and poverty, that thou art rich. And I know the blasphemy of them which say they are Jews and not, but are the synagogue of Satan. Fear none of those things which thou shalt suffer. Behold, the devil shall cast some of you into prison, that you may be tried, and you shall have tribulation 10 days. Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give thee a crown of life. He that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith unto the churches, he that overcometh shall not be hurt of the second death. Now, once again, before we consider the appropriateness of the revelation of Jesus Christ, given to us there in verse 8, and the appropriateness of the promise given in verse 12, let's consider what the events or conditions or context of this church period particularly were. The Smyrna church followed the Ephesus church and covers that period of time when tremendous persecution was levelled against the Christians in the early centuries. There's a whole chapter in Great Controversy which describes that period in quite some depth and detail, giving to us the historical events that took place over that period of time. The chapter's called Persecution in the First Centuries. And during that time, literally tens of thousands, possibly hundreds of thousands of Christians perished at the hands of the pagan Romans, and later, of course, at the hands of the early period of papal supremacy. And many people find it rather difficult to understand why it is that a God of almighty power, who professes great love for his children, should permit this kind of suffering to come upon his people. But the answer is not very hard to find when we look at the character of God and the character which must be found in those who follow after their precious Saviour. I'd like to read now some thoughts on page 47 of the book Great Controversy in this respect, which say, the mysterious providence which permits the righteous to suffer persecution at the hand of the wicked has been a cause of great perplexity to many who are weak in the faith. Some are even ready to cast away their confidence in God because he suffers the basest of men to prosper, while the best and purest are afflicted and tormented by their cruel power. Now let's think about this for a moment in the context of God's character. We understand from studying God's character that he places a wall of protection or defense against around the people upon this earth, and even the wicked enjoy that circle of protection up to a given point of time. Let our minds go back, for instance, to the days of Elisha. And you recall how one morning the servant of Elisha woke up, and what did he find surrounding the city of Samaria? A great Syrian army. And they had come to do harm to the people of Israel and to the prophet and to the king. And what was the reaction of the servant, do you remember? He was terrified. And he came in to inform the prophet of this tremendous threat to the city and to themselves. The prophet wasn't the least bit disturbed. What did he do? He prayed God to open the eyes of the servant, and then what did the servant see? An army of angels that surrounded them and stood between them and their enemies. And the result was, of course, that Elisha and his servant came to no harm whatsoever. Now, outside of the circle of protection, there is a being who is the great destroyer, and he is bent on penetrating that wall of protection in order to do what?
To destroy
all those folk who are within, be they righteous or wicked. When we spent time studying the story of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, we saw how the continued apostasy of that great monarch was threatening and did eventually affect the removal of that circle of protection. Now we recognize that the only possible way in which Satan can have power to destroy mankind is when that circle of protection has been removed. Let's go back to page 36, for instance, in the book This Great Controversy, and read this thought that's laid out for us on this particular page. The statement says, we cannot know how much we owe to Christ for the peace and protection which we enjoy. It is the restraining power of God that prevents mankind from passing fully under the control of Satan. The disobedient and unthankful have great reason for gratitude for God's mercy and long-suffering in holding in check the cruel, malignant power of the evil one. And did you catch the main thought here? It doesn't say just the righteous, but the disobedient and the unthankful have great reason for gratitude for God's mercy and long-suffering in holding in check the cruel, malignant power of the evil one. So God actually protects Satan's friends from Satan, who would destroy them if he only could get the opportunity. But when men pass the limits of divine forbearance, that restraint is removed. God does not stand toward the sinner as an executioner of a sentence against transgression, but he leaves the rejecters of his mercy to themselves to reap that which they have sown. Now then, that is the only way in which wicked people can suffer destruction. Let's put the word in here, the wicked, and of course the righteous as well, are given protection from God. Now the righteous people of God have the same circle of protection around them, except of course it's much stronger and much closer and much more powerful, because their righteousness enables them to receive more of God's blessing and benefit, and God stands much closer to them. And yet we find that upon Christians who are living very, very close to God, there are times befalls tremendous calamities, tremendous troubles and difficulties. And there's a tendency on the part of some folk to assume that this can only be because the righteous have committed some grievous sin. Now, if that is so, if that is the reason why they have lost the circle of God's protection because they committed some grievous sin, then God is anything but equal and fair in his dealings with mankind. Let's take, for instance, the city of Jerusalem, which fell in the year AD 17 when the Romans came against it and destroyed it. Now, consider very carefully the depths of wickedness to which Israel had to descend before they finally cast off the protection of God. Let's now go back, for instance, to a man like, shall we say, Job, the great patriarch, and we'll read something of his story in just a moment. And we ask ourselves the question, because this man certainly lost the circle of God's protection, Satan did have power over him. He took away his health, he took away his children, he took away his possessions, and almost took away his life as well. Now, do we find that in the life story of Job that there was a wickedness in that man's life comparable to that which was achieved by the Jews by AD 70? Anything but. On the contrary, we find no record of Job being an unrighteous man. Let's go back to the book of Job for a moment. And bear in mind that in looking at this particular problem, we are giving consideration to the question as to why there could be so many righteous people submitted to Satan's power, so many tens of thousands of folk who were committed to martyrdom, when God could certainly very easily have exercised his physical power to have saved them. So we turn back now to the first verses of the book of Job. And chapter 1 verse 1 says, "There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was perfect and upright, and one who feared God and eschewed evil." What does the word eschewed mean? Shunned. Shunned it, right? And the idea of hatred of evil is also there. He hated it so much he shunned it and had naught to do with it. So the inspired word of God begins by saying that Job was a righteous and an upright man, a perfect man. Now we come down to verse 8 in the same chapter, and now we find that the God of heaven is talking to Satan personally and says in verse 8, "Hast thou considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in the earth, a perfect and an upright man, one that feareth God and escheweth evil?" So we find that God is complaining about Job being a wicked man, or testifying he was a righteous man. The answer is obvious. Now comes what we might consider to be the best evidence of all. Not that we doubt God's evidence for one moment, because when God speaks, of course, he speaks the truth, he speaks no lie. But when God confronted Satan with the question, "Have you considered the perfection and uprightness of Job?" Satan did not contend with that evaluation. He said in verse 9, "Does Job fear God for naught?" Or in modern language, "Does Job fear God for nothing?" So does Satan at this point make any attempt to deny that Job was a virtuous and upright man? No attempt whatsoever. So what was Job, obviously? A virtuous and an upright man. And therefore, he certainly was not in the position where his sins, which God doesn't even hold against him, were such as to remove that circle of protection. Yet, the circle was removed, right? So it had to be removed for some other reason than the reason of Job's sinfulness, which of course didn't exist. So there was another reason altogether. And we know how God said to Satan, all right, he said, I'll surrender him to your power, I'll take away my protection, as verse 12 says, and the Lord said to Satan, behold, all that he hath is in thy power, only upon himself put not forth thine hand. So Satan went forth from the presence of the Lord, and then we know the fearful troubles which came upon Job as he lost his children, his flocks, his herds, his camels, his asses, and his servants, and even some of the buildings, his houses have been built at great labor and expense. And the second time, Job came back to argue with God, and God continued to testify as to Job's faithfulness, and again in the second chapter, Satan admits the faithfulness of Job, but contends that if a little more pressure is brought upon him, that Job will bend under that pressure and begin to curse God to his face. Now, I'll turn to a statement now, which is a very fine comment upon this particular experience of Job. It comes to us again from the Bible Commentary, Volume 3, and this time the page is page 1140. And this is a principle which is well worth remembering because of the other reason why the circle of protection can be removed from us when we suffer the fate of a martyr, or perhaps suffer great trouble and distress at the hands of calamities. Page 1140, Volume 3 of the Bible Commentary. It is very natural for human beings to think that great calamities are a sure index of great crimes and enormous sins, but men often make a mistake in thus measuring character. Do you recall when Christ and his disciples passed the blind man, what was their question? Who did sin, this man or his parents? Their assumption was that man's suffering was a direct result of that man's own sins or that man's parents' direct sins. But Christ said no. He said neither. This has happened that God's name may be glorified. Now I'll read further on page 1140, Bible Commentary, Volume 3. We are not living in the time of retributive judgment. Good and evil are mingled and calamities come upon all. Sometimes men do pass the boundary line between God's protecting care and then Satan exercises his power upon them and God does not interpose. Job was sorely afflicted and his friends sought to make him acknowledge that his suffering was a result of sin and cause him to feel under condemnation. They represented his case as that of a great sinner, but the Lord rebuked them for their judgment of his faithful servants. So what was the assumption or the conclusion drawn by those three friends of Job? They said, you're suffering greatly, therefore you must have sinned greatly. But God said, no, this is not true. Next paragraph goes on to say, there is wickedness in our world, but all the suffering is not the result of a perverted course of life. Job is brought distinctly before us as a man whom the Lord allowed Satan to afflict. The enemy stripped him of all he possessed, his family ties were broken, his children were taken from him. For a time his body was covered with loathsome sores, and he suffered greatly. His friends came to comfort him, but they tried to make him see that he was responsible by his sinful course for his afflictions. But he defended himself and denied the charge, declaring, miserable comforters are you all. By seeking to make him guilty before God and deserving of his punishment, they brought a grievous test upon him and represented God in a false light. But Job did not swerve in his integrity, his loyalty, and God rewarded his faithful servants. So all the way through, there's no suggestion that Job was an unrighteous man. So now we have a situation where, pardon me, where first of all, The wicked lose their circle of protection because of their wickedness. And there another situation where the righteous lose their circle of protection, not because of their wickedness, but because of their faithfulness. pardon me, does this sound like a contradiction? It does, doesn't it? And obviously, of course, there must be some deeper principle which brings to view what we term in this case the martyr principle, or the principle of suffering together with Jesus Christ. To understand this, of course, we must understand what is the most central and powerful element in the character of God. And what does the Bible say? God is love. And the Bible also says that with him there is no change. He is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Which means, of course, that God's love is so total, so infinite, that there's nothing can change that love in the slightest degree. What I mean to say here is this, of course, that irrespective of how badly you may behave, irrespective of how you may abuse the promises and privileges of God, no matter how wicked you may become, no matter what you do, that does not change God's love for you in the slightest degree. In other words, today, God still loves Satan today as much as he ever loved him when he was a bright and shining angel up in heaven, just as much. Now, certainly I'm not saying that God can have fellowship with Satan. They can't work together. And God can't force salvation on the devil. The devil must, of course, exercise his own choice, which he is doing, unfortunately, in choosing to continue a life of rebellion and working to destroy all of God's fair kingdom. But while God can't have fellowship with Satan, he certainly loves him just as much today as he ever did in the past. Now, love of that kind, total love of that kind, is total unselfishness, completely unselfish. There's not the slightest trace of selfishness in God whatsoever. And therefore, that love drives God to expend himself to whatever degree is necessary in order to bring salvation to other people. And that's why Jesus Christ came down to this earth, to reveal that love to mankind and to demonstrate that he would make any sacrifice, no matter what it might be, in order that others might be saved. And of course, Satan exhibits the opposite principle. Satan's principle is that he will sacrifice others, no matter how many it may be, in order to secure his own salvation. Now, Christ's garment is dipped in blood, as you read in Revelation. So is Satan's. Christ's garment is dipped in his own blood, spilled and spent to save others, but Satan's garment is dipped in whose blood? The blood of others, to bring him salvation and honor and success and so forth. Now, these two principles, the principle of self-sacrificing love versus the principle of self-serving love, are the two principles being fought out in the great controversy. And of course, the world today argues, the same as Satan himself argues, that the only way to prosper is to do so at the expense of others, to elevate yourself no matter what it may cost the other person. The Christian principle, which is foolishness in the eyes of the world, is that the only way to elevate yourself is to do it at the expense of your own life in service for those around about you, as God may direct from day to day. Now then, we are in this world as God's witnesses, as you read back in the book of Isaiah, as we mentioned, of course, this morning, and I think again this afternoon. We are to witness to the character of God by revealing that character in our daily experience. And inasmuch as that character is the principle of self-sacrificing, self-renouncing love, the principle of self-abnegation, then when a situation arises which calls upon us to exhibit that character and to pay the cost and to enter into a life of self-sacrifice, if God should prevent Satan from attacking us so we can give that revelation, he would then prevent us from manifesting the character of God. Right? And God can't do that. God cannot and will not deny us the privilege, and I say again, the privilege of revealing that very beautiful and wonderful element of self-sacrificing love.
Let me turn to a Bible statement at this point. I'll just get the reference in the book Desire of Age. I know it's in Philippians, but I just forgot the exact verse at the moment. It's quoted in this particular book, so I'll quote it from here, although it's strictly a scripture verse. It's Philippians 1 and verse 29. And there we find that Paul wrote and said, "Unto you it is given in the behalf of Christ not only to believe on him, but also to suffer for his sake." That's a gift of God. It is given to us in behalf of Christ not only to suffer, to believe in him, but also to suffer for his sake. Philippians 1 verse 29. Now comes a comment on that. And of all the gifts that heaven can bestow upon men, fellowship with Christ and his sufferings is the most weighty trust and the highest honour. Now of course, suffering together with Jesus Christ achieves much more than it does achieve more than simply bringing salvation to the perishing around about us. It also achieves a very remarkable and wonderful development in a person's character. And when you find a person in life who's suffered much, those folk, especially if they haven't become bitter but have been blessed with the graces of Christ's character and therefore do not have a bitter spirit, those folk have a depth of character, they have a sympathy, they have an understanding, they have a love, they have a tact, they have a kindness about them which is not experienced or enjoyed by those who have come very lightly and easily through life and not been burdened with suffering and so on and so forth. Now during the Smyrna period, we find now a people who were prepared to die rather than to break the relationship between themselves and their Heavenly Father. They recognize it is less a calamity to suffer whatever might befall than to in any way at all disobey the will of God. They came under the same pressure which Christ came under in the matter of temptation, and like him they said, "Man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of God." And the Lord told them they would suffer, but he said in verse 10, "Fear none of those things which thou shalt suffer. Behold, the devil shall cast some of you into prison, that you may be tried, and you shall have tribulation 10 days. Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give thee a crown of life." Now in heaven, will the martyrs occupy an honoured place or a very lowly place? A very highly honoured place. They occupy the honoured place because at the sacrifice of their lives they have borne witness to the principles of God's character. They have been witness to God's character. They have demonstrated to men just what God is really like. They have shown that no cost can ever be considered too great in order to bring blessing and salvation to their fellow men. And revealing that character, of course, they honour God and draw very much nearer to him and thus become fitted to enjoy a part and a place in the eternal kingdom. Now very obviously, of course, this persecution back in the days of the Smyrna church kept the church much purer, because a person had to really believe what he believed to take a stand with the church in those days. And therefore the persecutions of that period tended to slow down and even to hold the apostasy which had been developing in the Christian church, and retarded the greater apostasy to come in the Pergamos period, which followed after that of the Sardis period. And we look back today and honour those faithful people during the Smyrna period who remained true to God regardless. And they are a witness to us, of course, because in the coming days and months and years, if there are years left, we too are going to be placed through a fearful period of persecution when we'll have the opportunity of standing as they stood. But we'll only do this, of course, if in the meantime we have developed the strength of character sufficient to resist the temptations of Satan. Well, time has gone again to this study period, so we'll stop at this point and we'll pick up this theme. We meet again tomorrow at 9:30 on Sabbath morning.